Hello and welcome to Is This Just Fantasy, the podcast where every week two nerds get together and discuss a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I read this book in the dark room, scrutinising the art to exploit the weaknesses of the species that created it, Duncan Nichol.
That might be Duncan's strangest introduction yet, but I promise it does make sense because this week we read Heir to the Empire by Timothy Zorn, the second, well, the follow-up to our Dark Empire episode from last year. Duncan has once again made me read a Star Wars novel, and he will never be forgiven.
Happy May the 4th.
In June.
Yes, Geordie, I got you to read this. I'm a massive Star Wars fan. I have been my entire life. I love both old canon legends. I love the new stuff coming out, and this May I just got the bug again. I just really want to dive back into the Star Wars universe and share it with my friend. And what better way to do that than with this book, Heir to the Empire by Timothy Zorn, the book that relaunched the Star Wars expanded universe way back in 93, I think it was.
Yes,
a real seminal piece.
Duncan and I both listen to a podcast every so often called the Old Canon Star Wars Book Club. I believe that's true that you also listen to that, Duncan.
I am a huge fan of it.
I am an okay fan of it. Much like the previous book club which Jesse Cox ran. I like Jesse Cox. He's a funny YouTuber. Much like the previous one, I was about to say the old podcast he did, but this is the old one. I think their discussions, it's really hard to understand what's going on unless you've seen the thing they have, because they don't go into a lot of detail. I don't mean to slag off another book podcast. They're much more successful than we are.
Way more successful than us. But I know how you feel, and it's something that I'm always very conscious of. But for someone who, when they're doing the first 20 issues of the original Marvel Star Wars comic book run, and they're like, yes, I've read these. I know exactly what you're on about. Yes. Darth Vader did have a chat with Princess Leia at a banking planet to discuss the deposit of the Alderaanian crown jewels. Of course he did.
And I brought it up because I wanted to point out a distinction you made, which is that you said this sort of reignited Star Wars, because there was additional, what we now call legends material, already being made before this. You had comic books set out by Marvel, you had tie-in novels like Galaxy's Edge. Is it called Galaxy's Edge, or is that the theme park?
That's a modern example. Galaxy's Edge theme park, there was a tie-in novel called Dark Spar. I think what you're thinking of, though, is Splinters of the Mind's Eye.
That is not what I'm referring
to. And the Han Solo novels. No?
I'm talking about the Han Solo one, like Galaxy's End or something. Is that what it's called?
Han Solo at... Oh, was it called? Something's End.
Star's End, right?
Star's End.
Yeah.
Thank you.
A book I haven't read. I don't know why I'm talking about it. But yes, this is sort of supposed to be the new kickoff. A lot of the time when big Star Wars nerds, and they were talking about this a lot, especially when The Force Awakens was due to come out or had just come out, were saying, man, now we're never going to get adaptations of these works. This is my favourite part of Star Wars. The stuff that wasn't made by George Lucas.
Not an uncommon stance to take, surprisingly. But you're absolutely right. This was very popular, and what it did and why it kicked off is mainly for one fact, that this was the first bit of Star Wars media after the original trilogy that was really allowed to push the characters and the universe forward. Everything else was kind of a prequel, midquel, bit of a wheel spinner. No one was really allowed to do the next step. Even the Marvel comics, after the end of Return of the Jedi, they all sit on Endor. Like, the comic book artist was just not allowed to relocate the characters because you didn't know if George was going to come in and pick up exactly where he left off. And this is the first time where George kind of went, I don't care, go for it.
And the thing is, And that's personal, because that's exactly what you were talking about last time we recorded, when we were talking about The Gunslinger. You were talking about how right now all the stuff that Disney makes is in this same interwar period. It's all like the Mandalorian stuff is in the space between Return of the Jedi and The Force Awakens. The comic books are set in between, you know, Empire Strikes Back and Return of a Jedi, the novels are like in the same similar period, and now the newest novels are all pre-Republic. They are in these isolated zones of safety, where there's room to flex, but nothing is going forward. Nothing is taking place after the Rise of Skywalker.
And to be honest, I think that is as much a problem now as it probably felt back then.
Mm.
You know, you sit around going, well, why should I invest in this media if it's, I'm going to say, matter in terms of quiet stories? And that's not a knock against the quality of any of these works. But I think if you enjoy a fantasy world, a fantasy multiverse, yes, it's really fun to read those tiny little niche stories. And some authors craft beautiful tales. There's a story, Geordie, which is basically MASH during the Clone Wars.
Hmm.
It follows like Jedi medics and their kind of experience fighting the Clone Wars. And like, that's a really cool little slice of what Star Wars can be. But people like to see Luke Skywalker, Han Solo, Princess Leia, Chewbacca, Lando Calrissian actually taking the next steps and developing as characters. And that's what this book, I think, kind of starts to give us.
Yeah.
Leaving it there.
The Star Wars pre-Disney purchase new canon stuff, it had a reputation, and this was what I gathered when The Force Awakens was coming out. So this was many years ago now. When it was coming out, the impression I had was that it was extremely bloated, and it was very, it was full of minutiae. It was full of these, like, weird events, which you sort of just had to roll with. It's sort of like my impression of, like, what it's like to read a lot of Marvel, where other writers come in, they make changes to the world, and then you just have to put up with it. There's no rolling back the clock. I mean, they do in Marvel constantly, but those events still happened.
That's definitely so. And what we're talking about today, Heir to the Empire, kicked off in the Star Wars sort of canon, this era known as the New Republic. And in terms of literary works, it wasn't like a one consistent narrative. This was the era where they were Lucasfilm, they were just sort of bringing in established science fiction authors or fantasy authors in a few cases, and sort of just saying, here, give us a trilogy, give us a one-off, and we'll just keep kind of building it forward without like a real plan in mind. I suppose you could consider this whole era as the story of fighting the Imperial Remnant. You know, Palpatine's down, but there are still pockets of resistance, Imperial resistance out there in the galaxy.
In my copy of the book, Duncan, at the back, they have a whole chronology of all of the like Legends material that takes place, you know, pre-original trilogy, in between the original trilogy and after. And the after period has like distinct eras where it's like, this is 5 years after the destruction of the second Death Star. This is 20 years after. This is 40 years after.
Yes. You're right. And so what they did, so this era of the New Republic, that was that bitty bit. Then around the time the prequels were coming out, they decided, right, we're actually going to tell one big story now. And that was called the New Jedi Order series. And so it's still lots of different authors, but then they started doing it where it's like, no, we have a plan. There's going to be an overarching plot, and we're going to really try to actually push new characters, original characters that came out of the books and not related to the films, bring them more to the forefront.
Mm.
You know, this isn't just a Luke, Han and Leia show anymore. But that's all to come, and I love it, and I've read a lot of it. I've nowhere near read all of it. It's huge. We're talking over 100 books. It's one of those things, Geordie, where if I said only one in 20 Star Wars books was worth your time, you're still reading like 15 novels. It's crazy.
And so, this one has the reputation, or this trilogy has the reputation of being the very best. Am I wrong about that? Is there better stuff to come after this?
No. There is. There is some really good stuff to come.
That's not
really
what I asked. Stuff.
Damn you. It certainly is a contender for the best. Like, this trilogy is up there. It's either the best, Geordie, or it's the top three, or the top five. Like,
it's three this books. Is some... How could it...
Oh, that's because Darth Bane only has one decent book in that trilogy.
Okay.
But you're right. This is the best. I would actually say if you read this book, if you're thinking about getting to expanded Star Wars, read this book. If you don't like it, maybe this isn't for you, would be my honest opinion.
Well, we got to find out if it is for me, Duncan, because you have said this is the best, and therefore that implies that you like it. I have not yet given an opinion on what I thought of this book.
Then let's start reviewing it, Geordie. Everyone knows I love it. What did you think? Come on, summarize it.
I think, Duncan, that this was a very good book.
I'm so happy.
Yeah, you had to win it out of me. I had to read this in front of my colleagues, Duncan, in the staff room where I work. People saw me reading a Star Wars novel. There was no hiding it. But yes, I did enjoy it. I really did. It feels like a forward, faithful adaptation. It's enjoyable, and it feels nice to immerse yourself in Star Wars in a format you're not really used to. The fact that it makes this translation from screen to book means that the actions people undertake in it, like when they're piloting a starship, you can't just see them pressing buttons. It has to use actual tech jargon, and it's enjoyable. It feels like a super deep dive into a Star Wars space. It makes me want to play like a Star Wars role-playing game and inhabit the space again.
I'm so happy you liked it. Coming back and revisiting this book for quite possibly the third time, I was once again really impressed by not only how loyal it was in recreating the feel of the original films,
sure,
but also how I actually think Timothy Zahn has been quite brave in the new elements and new characters he was prepared to give a substantial amount of page time to.
He sure was. And it's not really, at least yet. I think, again, this is just from inhabiting nerd spaces. My understanding is that Timothy Zahn becomes very precious about the character of Thrawn, and he really falls in love with writing the character, so much so that he's basically a hero in a number of the books that he writes about him, and including Outbound Flight, the third book I've read in the Star Wars universe, where Thrawn is basically the hero of the story.
That is quite possibly the case. I think Zahn got a little burnt. Another character that appears in this book, and we'll discuss later, Mira Jade, sure, one of his creations. Another author takes that character later on and does things I believe Zahn was very vocally against. And I think ever since then he's like, okay, I'm keeping this one. This one's my baby. You won't touch him.
Until Star Wars Rebels comes out.
Well, exactly. Until he gets brought over into the new canon. That was the level of his popularity. Mm. So Geordie, you like the book. I love the book. Let's start out. This book opens and we get introduced immediately to the character of Thrawn.
Yes, very
what
surprising.
What did you think of him?
So, I've already met Thrawn, of course, because I've read Outbound Flight. This is his first proper introduction, and he's much... Outbound Flight, I enjoyed well enough. It's a book that overstayed its welcome, but it was very obvious why people enjoy the character of Thrawn. In this book, it's so much more. He's so much more appropriate and so much more interesting and enjoyable to read about. It's a lot like reading a Sherlock Holmes novel. You inhabit the character Dr. Watson, or in this case, Captain, was it Pelion?
I pronounce it Pelion, but that does not mean it's right.
Yeah, Pelion seems about right. So Captain Pelion is a witness to Thrawn's genius, and he gets to sort of marvel at what he's doing. And what's really great about it is that Captain Pelion is always like a little bit in the dark and is always a little bit frustrated and confused. And it strikes a very good tenor because you have this captain who appears to be completely decent captain in terms of like his ability to run a ship, and so when Thrawn is making these high level chess plays and he's a little bit baffled by it, that's a good lens for us as readers to be held at a distance from Thrawn's genius and to know intellectually that he has a plan. And Zahn also plays with things like dramatic irony, where Thrawn is able to almost see through the plot in order to ascertain what other people are doing, but also, crucially, get things wrong and make wrong assumptions, which makes our heroes look yet more heroic. he acts as this great antagonist, because you enjoy the chapters where he's present. You enjoy trying to keep up with him and see what his plans are and figure out what's going on at Sluice Vein. What does he need at this secret mountain? What's his overall plan? But you also like seeing the points where he's being decisive and he's getting in the way of the heroes, and you see where they are falling into his traps, and it raises the tension.
I'm so glad you brought that Sherlock Holmes element up so quickly, Geordie. I've always said, that what really makes this character work is that you come off the Star Wars trilogy and you have the Dark Knight Vader,
mm-hmm.
and you have the maniacal, cackling evil emperor. So to get this Moriarty figure, this genius, this chess player, he's very different. He's not physically intimidating. He doesn't have superpowers like the previous villains.
Something which repeatedly happened in both Outbound Flight and the Revenge of the Sith book we read was that Palpatine is obviously the master manipulator, but he also has magical powers helping him. The whole point of him is that he has the entire universe in the palm of his hand and everything goes according to his plan, and it's so much more enjoyable and so much more impressive to read about Thrawn doing similar levels of manipulation purely by intellect. He doesn't have any magic on his side. He's making literal, actual mistakes, and then he corrects for those mistakes. That's so much more interesting and engaging and intimidating than any of the stuff Palpatine was doing.
We have said previously how a villain can be so much more engaging, or intelligence is so much better written when the characters make mistakes and then you see them have to come up with other plans.
That's right.
You know, they're not omnipotent. And I do think, particularly in this first book, Thrawn, maybe because we're a little bit further back, just sits on the right side of that. He doesn't seem too clever, too omnipotent.
At the moment, just. Maybe. I mean, I think there are times where it pushes credulity a little bit, but that's part of what you enjoy about stories about Sherlock Holmes-like figures. They are so intelligent, you know, you watch Sherlock or House, and, you know, they make these huge leaps of logic to get to the right location, and that's part of the genius, that's part of the appeal. I was just going to say, I don't want to hone in on this one character too much, because then we would be making the same mistake as Zorn.
One last thing.
Very well, keep going.
I just one last thing, though, that I really like about this character, particularly, and I think it's set up in this book, and we maybe over the course, not to give spoilers for the whole trilogy, you see this sort of progress. It's that at the beginning, it's really he tries to be I'm not a slave to my ego.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm not Darth Vader. I'm not going to throw a hissy fit. I'm not going to start killing. He does do exactly
killing that. Every...
That's not the best example. But I like the fact that he's we've lost today. I'm just going to hands up, guys. Let's retreat.
Yeah,
I think I
like that too. Absolutely.
Adamant.
Yeah, because the only other figure that fills in that role, and I've seen this in Star Wars comic books, is other writers have tried to turn Grand Moff Tarkin into that figure. He's the big strategist and manipulator and intimidating threat. And he's an idiot. He's completely overconfident. He puts all his eggs in one basket and then gets exploded for it.
Which is his entire character. Something that they do in the expanded universe on Tarkin, which is so baffling.
Mm.
Have you ever heard of the thing called the Tarkin Doctrine?
No.
In Star Wars?
No, I haven't.
Lord Ive, people. So, this thing called Tarkin Doctrine, which is meant to be how Tarkin came up with this idea to help have power in the Empire. And it's all about having a vast mobile fleet. And to be fair, there's the element of fear is what keeps people in control.
Sure.
And that's why he thought, the Death Star, the fear of it, the threat of using this weapon will help us rule the galaxy. But that completely goes against the idea that he thought, no, I want to have a vast mobile fleet of very uniform ships. It's it doesn't work. That's not his character. He has a folly. And that's why everyone who goes for super weapons, which Thrawn does not use, a fail. I also love the fact that he doesn't go, there's not a second Death Star in this. But you're right, let's stop focusing on Thrawn. Let's go back to the rest of the plot. How about our heroes, Geordie?
Yes, so
you've met them before?
We've met them before. So this book primarily follows Luke, Han, and Leia, each of them taking on different roles within confronting the threat of Thrawn. Interestingly, they don't know there is a threat from Thrawn, that he's lurking in the shadows so much that they are circling the drain of the rising evil.
I mean, what a beautiful way to put it. And you're right, and what I really like about in the opening of this story, we see a little bit of the Republic that they're trying to form. And I love this element of how they're actually having just very mundane problems.
Absolutely. I really like that.
Running a democracy.
I absolutely really like that. Like, it's always been this sort of blasé, thrown away thing in Star Wars where there are just two things you need to know about non-imperial power. They say, oh, the Republic was a mess, and that's that. They say the Republic is a mess, and then they say the New Republic is, like, picking up the pieces of the Empire. And you see that in Mandalorian. That's, like, a throwaway thing, but, like, we can't help out these Outer Rim planets because there's too much chaos going on. But you don't get a lens in on that actual politicking. And I don't like anything about the way people talk about politics in the Old Republic because of a whole bunch of reasons, and I don't want to get into it, but it's all to do with how people talk about the prequels, and I can't bloody stand talking about the prequels anymore.
So let's talk about how the New Republic is portrayed in this book, Geordie. We get an insight, we get a very high level insight, to be fair, you know, where Leia is right up there alongside Mon Mothma, sort of the heroes of the rebellion. But there's also these other people that have come in.
Yep.
And now I'm going to butcher this name, but there is a character here, a Bothan, called Phaelon?
I assume it's pronounced Phaelon, yeah?
Phaelon, who sort of represents this simultaneously, probably very reasonable voice, and at the same time just so frustrating to our heroes. Because we know our heroes are right.
Of course.
They're the heroes.
Yeah.
But... And he's being antagonistic towards them. And you're just like, well, it's annoying. But no, it's not annoying. It's great. He's perfectly pitched as annoying or irritating. Because you just look and go, oh, he's just not being unfair enough. Like, you can't quite call him out. You can't quite go, damn, this man, he's working against the democracy.
Mm.
He's just the opposing voice.
He's sort of the Thomas Jefferson of the New Republic. Like, you weren't here for the Revolutionary War, man. You were off in the background somewhere. And now that we're in power, you want to take the reins?
But is that not part of a democracy? Why do you let the leaders of the paramilitary group that took power continue to have power?
I totally agree. I mean, Phaelon doesn't say that explicitly, but if he did, I would agree with him. Maybe General Akbar shouldn't be the supreme ruler of the army.
Now, I wouldn't say this... Like, this is some really interesting ideas. I would say it is given a fair bit of background, particularly in terms of page count. Like, I don't think Zorn... He's like, shows you it, and then goes, okay, now let's get our characters out in the world.
Exactly. It reflects on all the decisions our characters make. They're doing things to support the Republic, or they're doing things because they're impinged by the New Republic and its rules, or its security. There's a big part of this book, like, Lando is brought in because they need to start going behind their own Republic's back. The thing they are creating, they're like, we can't do the things we need to do in normal politics. We need to go back to doing our rebel shit. So we need to, you know, start talking to criminals again.
It's something that's been kind of brought up a bit, I think, in the most recent Ahsoka series on Disney Plus.
Okay.
This idea of, if you have a group of people who were so steadfast in their beliefs, they rebelled against the last government, surely they'll just do it again. Like, how do you transition? How do you go, no, I disagree, but not like last time when I disagreed. This time I'll disagree and just sit back.
Yeah, revolutions tend to end up being pretty messy when they try to make a new government, and you tend to get people like... Actually, the more I think about this, it's amazing that Admiral Akbar isn't, like, an actual, like, fascist dictator, because he's set up perfectly to fit into that role if he just went a little further. Speaking of people giving up power, though, I'm going to hone in on Han Solo. I'm going to say something first and foremost. Timothy Zorn made a very good choice when he made Han Solo immediately resign his commission as general. Han Solo should never have been a general.
Are you saying George Lucas got it wrong?
Yes, he got it wrong. Why the hell was... Why was Han Solo a general? I genuinely had forgotten that they ever made him... Gave him that role. That's ridiculous.
Did they? I'm thinking, like, because when did they even do that? Like, he... Hoth? Is he a general on
Hoth?
No,
he's like... He doesn't even work for the rebellion on Hoth. It's like... It's Endor. Like, after he gets unfrozen, he gets made a general.
That's insane. Is he not just... I'm going to have to rewatch the movies. If you'd asked me, I would have said they just call him Commander. Because he puts together a strike force. Like, he does nothing general-like. But you're right. I'm glad he resigns. If anything, Lando has more of the character to actually, like, organize and run things.
That's definitely true. Like, he's an administrator. Han Solo should always be a captain. I mean, maybe he's going to progress in... Actually, well... So, Han Solo, as depicted by Timothy Zorn, in some ways, you're like, yes, you have captured the voice of this character, and you're inhabiting the inside of his head quite well. I really like wife guy Han Solo. I really like the... I am super in love with Leia. I'm extremely anxious about losing her and her unborn children, and that's going to inhibit. It's going to change all of my actions throughout this book. I like that. I do think that Han Solo is fitting in a little bit too well to politicking. It feels more like he's been written as like a spy than like a smuggler. And I think there is an important distinction in between those two sort of tropey characters.
So he has a little bit more of an expert, well, just too much insight, actually. He just has too much, like, oh, I'll do this because this will inform Phelan's actions or what's going
Absolutely.
On. I think he just needs to have one or two moments, I think, in this story where he does something that just, maybe it's the right thing to do. And you can see it from Han Solo's approach. Say it was, I don't know, involved protecting Leia. But then afterwards, Leia just turned around and be like, you know the political disaster you've just created for
me. Well,
that
kind of does happen, but Han Solo was shown to be in the right. And that's after, what's it called? This is literally impossible to know, like Bespin, when they're attacked. And then afterwards, they get back on the Millennium Falcon and Han just leaves. He just flies away. He doesn't wait for them to go back. And Leia wants to go back and do diplomacy. And he just goes back to Coruscant. And he doesn't tell anyone he's doing this until they're already on their way.
True, but I think that's the point. Because he's shown to be in the right, then it almost makes him look like, no, he's just really good
yes.
at this. He knew that was the right decision
and
to just get out of Dodge.
Yes, you're right. And I'm sorry for, like, no but in you and, like, sort of, like...
Well, I think the thing I'm asking
because
for there
generally,
is...
I think you are
Leia
correct.
Says... Yeah, because Leia says, this will cause me trouble. But we actually never see that problem. Yeah,
exactly.
Like, that's not in the
exactly.
book.
Exactly. Like, it doesn't lead to a problem. It probably should, but anyway, the point is that characters in this book are, like, really smart. All of them are really smart. It's not just Thrawn. Everyone has had, like, 2 points put into their IQ stat. That just appears to be how... Timothy Zorn likes to create conflict in these stories. I think it works, for one thing. I like the fact that we have these competent characters. It's enjoyable to see characters be competent. You know, especially like the naval battle at the end. They come up with these tactics to confront Thrawn's strategies. And I think that there is a coherent theme throughout the book of the plucky rebels being good at tactics, but losing out in terms of strategy, and there is a difference between those things, but they are just like just smarter than I remember them being in the movies.
And I think that might be one of the few things that someone could get turned off on. I think someone could pick up on this point, well, this doesn't feel quite like Han Solo. But then I do then think that's why Zorn did a very clever decision of setting this 5 years later, because I think that then gives you that kind of in-universe flex, just to let you kind of go, oh, it's a stretch, but it's a little stretch, and it could have happened in that time gap.
Yeah,
they all just got a bit wiser. They fought with the war for an extra 5 years.
Especially, say, Luke, for example. Luke in Return of a Jedi is a tricky character because a lot of the stuff he does is kind of set up as a twist. When he shows up at the beginning, you're not supposed to know whether or not he's fallen to the dark side or not. The way in which he's dressed, he's all in black, he's quite spooky, he's force choking people. That's all stuff which is to lead you to believe that, oh, something's different about Luke. He's not behaving the way he was last time. And he's also a much wiser character. He's a true Jedi Knight at that point. And what a Jedi Knight is, at this point in the history of Star Wars, it's kind of nebulous. Like, in this book, they never use the word Sith. Like, that's not a part of common Star Wars parlance. Even though, if you go back, that was supposed to be in the original Star Wars title crawl, the word Sith. They're referred to as Dark Jedi in this book.
That's absolutely right. In fact, I can throw in a little trivia in here. What species is Thrawn's elite Death Squad soldiers made up of?
Oh, fuck. I don't remember off the top of my head, I'm sorry. They're Ngoshi?
Now you're messing with my pronunciation. Nguri?
I'm sure you're right, Duncan. I'm sure you're right. Nguri, that sounds fine by me.
Well, when Zorn came to write this, he actually originally wanted to call that species the Sith. He thought Darth Vader was the Lord of the Sith. So the Sith had to be a people somewhere.
I see. That's
and that
funny.
Was his original... That's how he genuinely interpreted it. And George Lucas had to step in and be like, no, that's not what I meant. And Zorn was like, well, you did not make that clear at any point.
There's something similar, actually, in regard to the Clone Wars, but we'll get back to that later.
So, right, you can see it's not fully formed. I think at this point, the Jedi are left... Well, I think there's two ways you can read it. One is the idea of the Jedi, you know, the very concept of Jedi is nebulous. But also it's the idea that Luke is trying to kind of rediscover, you know, the Empire wiped out what they are. He is trying to learn for himself and rediscover what the Jedi were and what he should be.
I wish Rey had been permitted to do this. That would have been so much more interesting. But yes, absolutely, there are these points in the story where he has to go, ooh, should a Jedi do this? I'm gonna do it anyway, but I feel like I'm kind of pushing a line here. But, like, whatever, I gotta do it.
Really nicely done. And I think Luke maybe doesn't get the most in this first book in the trilogy, in my opinion. I think he's just kind of building up to his more defining moral, ethical judgments later on. But he swings his lightsaber around, he has a chat with Ben, and he goes off on his own little adventure.
Yeah, he does. An adventure which keeps loop-de-looping in with Han and Leia, because the galaxy is 4 meters wide in this book.
Oh, well, it's when they both simultaneously show up to Lando's.
They both show up by coincidence
different independent
to different locations like 3 times.
Well, I don't know where I want to take this. On the one hand, I want to jump on and talk about Lando in this book.
Fair enough.
This is the start of a great thing that Lando does throughout the whole of the New Republic era Star Wars
novels.
You've
told me about this.
And that in every... Well, I'm saying it again. Go and listen to our lore dump episode on Dark Empire. Lando has a new business in like every series.
Yeah, he has a new get
it's
rich
like
quick
Brad Pitt in Ocean's 11. It's like every scene you cut back to him, he's just doing something different. And this scene, it's
an extremely confusing mining operation.
As I understand it, it's a mining operation that can only operate on like the dark side of a planet.
Yes.
So it's a mobile mining platform that has to like keep moving to stay in the shade because it's too close to the sun.
And I like that. That's a cool idea. But it's Imperial walkers. Like it's a mining facility sat on the back of like numerous Imperial walkers, which is cool. I love walking cities. How slowly is this planet rotating? Those things are like 4 miles, go at like 4 miles per hour.
I mean, I thought that. I can only imagine that he's, you know, his engineers have got in there. They're speeding up. They can boom, boom, boom,
boom. They're at a pleasant jog.
Are they all in step? Does it up, rise and fall? These are the major questions. Mm. It's one of the things where, like, I love some of the Star Wars aesthetic they get in this book. Obviously, most of the book is Star Wars aesthetic. This is the one moment, though, where I just went, it could have just been on tracks. Or like, but it didn't need to be the walkers.
Yeah, the last place we saw him was in Cloud City, a flying city. Why didn't he get another flying city?
I'm sure there's some deep lore science mumbo jumbo out there that could answer that question. But the character of Lando is off kind of a odd place in the Star Wars ethos because he's not a member of the original team.
No.
He comes in late, he's a bit of a villain, then he's on their side.
Yeah, exactly. He gets his big hurrah because he gets to destroy the second Death Star, and that's great. But you're right, he's only a hero in the final movie. Up till then, he's an antagonist, or at least until like the last 10 minutes of the second one. And as a result, I think he's a character that I think you could serve well as a Star Wars writer. He must be someone, it's a treat to use, because he has a lot of the same roguish charisma as Han, and Han's obviously like one of the most popular characters, but you don't have to tie him down to having a concrete arc. Lando's arc is he joins the good guys, but Han Solo did that in the first movie. So from there he gets to have other arcs like falling in love and becoming a general, and well, that's it. Those are the two things. But that means that Lando is still out there learning, changing, growing. So you can have your fun at having him be a playboy who's starting to get involved in being a part of the New Republic.
And to have that sort of seat there where, you know, his story arc, like with Han and Leia together.
Yes.
That's fine. That's set.
It's good.
Luke, he's a Jedi. I'm sure he won't have a romance anytime
soon.
That
makes sense. Everyone knows that Jedi are all celibate. That was definitely a rule that had been established right from the get-go and was invented during Episode 2 in order to create a forbidden romance between Anakin Skywalker and his old babysitter.
I've never had Padme described that way before. Yes, that is her role in Episode 2. When you watch episode one with what they are. Oh.
Very strange.
Ages.
Very strange, George.
Very strange.
George!
Anakin didn't have to be that young. But the actor did a decent job. Anyway, can you imagine Luke, like, finding that line in the ancient text years later and just going,
oops.
Oh. Oops.
Oh, Ben, you didn't tell me. I'm going to leap in on one thing before you go. I have seen the behind-the-scenes footage from The Empire Strikes Back. Not The Empire Strikes Back. The Phantom Menace. And I'm going to say this. I saw the auditions for numerous child actors, and Jake Lloyd was definitely the best actor out of all those kids.
Good.
Yes.
I liked him in that film. I just disagree with the creative decision to have Anakin appear so young.
I also don't like the fact that he's in that room, and I'm not going to revise history by saying that I like him in the role, because I don't, but it's not his fault. He was a child, and everything that happened afterwards is very sad. But you're right. Anakin should have been, like, 15 years old, not 10 years old. That's a much better age to do it, because then you can have him be plucky. Make him be younger than Luke. Make him be angsty. Make him be rebellious, so that he can butt heads with Obi-Wan in a much more interesting way. Like, when he's brashish in Attack of the Clones, it's frustrating, because you want him to be a Jedi Knight, and you don't understand why he would be trusted with any mission at all, because he should have grown out of it. So if you establish him as plucky and rebellious and angsty in the first one, and then you can have him grow up a little bit in the next one, so that there are still the seeds of the prior angstiness that can emerge later in moments of like high stress, for example. Anyway, it's too late to fix the Star Wars prequels, and we should all stop trying to think about it.
Oh, but that just worked so well, and they would have filled into what Uncle Owen says, you know, because it could then actually have him be like, I'm going, I have wanderlust, and everyone else be like, no, sir, you know, actually what they set up in the original trilogy. Anyway, you're right. So, back to the Empire. So, that's our old characters, the established cast.
Hang on, we can't just ignore Leia, even though the book does for the most part.
Okay, I don't want to be mean. So, Leia gets her fair share of... So Leia's meant to be the ambassador. She is the political mind of the team and of the New Republic. She's meant to show a level of level-headedness and just general political suave to help get factions on side. That is what she does best.
She's not...
Is that portrayed in this book?
She's not really given a chance to do that in this book. Part of what's complicated about it is that sort of the whole point is that her progress as a character is being forestalled by a bunch of stuff. So she's not allowed to train as a Jedi because she needs to do politics. And to be honest, that makes sense from Timothy Zahn's perspective. You don't want to reinvent Leia completely and have her, now she's a Jedi, now she's behaving like Luke. You want her to keep the traits that people liked in her from the previous things. So you want to have her be a gunslinger. You want to have her be the politically minded one because she is a princess and an ambassador. So you want to keep that stuff. But you've also decided that, of course, the Empire wants those Jedi twins that she's going to have. So now she's a bit of a... I'm not going to call her a complete damsel. She is being escorted around and she's being kept safe by all the other male characters. She is still independent and feisty and she does a judo throw at one point. But yes, she doesn't really get to strut her stuff. She's put off to the side and that's disappointing because I would like more Leia in this book.
I am going to say, obviously, I have the benefit of having the benefit, maybe not, having read the whole trilogy. These are complaints that do get well and truly addressed, I feel, later on. It's just in this first novel, with so much going on and new characters being brought in, Leia is just left a bit in the background.
I'm going to say something really surprising I noticed, and I kept waiting for this to be brought up. So for one thing, Luke makes Leia a lightsaber in this. This is done without any ceremony. So I guess at this point, they hadn't decided that lightsabers were a sort of spiritually important thing for a Jedi to make. It's just like, yeah, I can knock one of those out. It genuinely is said so casually. But I don't believe we're ever told what color it is. And I was really surprised by that. Like, you'd think that would be... You're a kid reading this book in 1993. You love to play Star Wars with your friends, and one of you wants to play the role of Princess Leia. Of course you want to know what color the lightsaber is, so you can have your little bamboo stick sword fights.
I'll be honest, So I've read the comic adaptation of this, and I know what color they pick there. You've actually taken me back by... I'm now thinking through this book and going... Do they not say?
No, they don't say.
Oh my God, I think they don't.
They genuinely don't.
Oh.
To be fair, they also don't say what Luke's lightsaber is. They only say it once, right towards the end. So maybe that's just something he was not interested in writing. Or maybe he found it, like, almost embarrassing to, like, mention what color it is. Like, as though that's important, and maybe he didn't think it is. But it absolutely is. Because the reader of this book wants to know, because they want to imagine it and they want to paint a picture in their head, and the colour of lightsabers is something that people fixate on.
I can definitely see both sides of this. I can see where Zahn as a writer would think, does it matter? Does it affect my plot? It's just a lightsaber, they are swinging it.
Mm-hmm.
And I completely agree with you. A young kid reading this wants to know, because that's what we were excited about.
Or
did you have a blue
man.
One or a green one? Or a grown man? Do you know what they don't have? Enough just... I think there should be more white lightsabers.
I agree. I think... I mean, I'm not one of those guys like, we should have 1,800 different colors and they should all be assigned to someone based on your role. You have a yellow one if you do this role because you're a Jedi Guardian. No, they should pick the colors they like. But yes, a white lightsaber would look cool. Duncan, what color is it? I need to know! What color is our lightsaber?
I think they make it blue.
I figured that was the case. That's what I was imagining.
I think there was definitely an element of... I think it's like the master has the green. She had a blue. They only really came in two colours. They had two different colours.
Yeah.
At this point.
I mean, there were supposed to only be two colours. There were supposed to be blue and they were supposed to be red. But during Return of the Jedi, they're like, oh shit, this just does not work for this scene. We can't see his lightsaber against a blue sky. We have to make it green.
Well, that's how these decisions get made. To hell with all the lore. If you want to know, by the way, you talk about like mysticism and creating a lightsaber. If I'm not mistaken, in Shadows of the Empire, Luke is literally sat in like Ben's hut over like a small oven trying to cook up his new lightsaber crystal. It's weird stuff.
I wonder if the Kyber crystal had been made into the source of a lightsaber's power yet, or if it was still this nebulous thing which George Lucas hadn't decided what it did yet.
I mean, other than the Kyber crystal in Spins of the Mind's Eye, I don't think they've been referenced. Unless they're in the novelizations of the movies. I'll leave that on the table. But I don't know. It's certainly not explicit in this book.
Duncan, I feel like the direction you've been pushing in for a little while, though I keep distracting you, is you want to talk about the new characters, aside from Thrawn.
Yes, I do. Because as I said, we get so many of them, and I think it's what made this book such a good launching point.
Mm.
So many of these characters come back throughout so many of the continues. If anything, this is almost the cast. Very few new characters get added and stick around after these books, and for Timothy Zahn as a writer to be picking up Star Wars, I think his decision to create so many new characters and give them so much focus and development is what made this work and this great.
Yes, that's, and it's interesting to me. So I write fan fiction in my spare time. I'm not gonna give any more details. I'm pretty sure I did say what it is on a previous podcast, but you're gonna have to find it if you want to find out what fanfics I write. But I noticed something surprising, which is that when I was reading fanfics as a kid, you know, I was like 13 years old and I was reading Naruto fanfiction, I remember not liking when authors would create their OCs because it's embarrassing to read someone's DeviantArt addition to the Naruto universe. And I feel like that is a serious thing which Star Wars writers must be wary about. You're creating these new characters who are just as cool as the original trilogy characters, right, guys? I've got my totally badass space assassin character who I want to fit in. And something I noticed recently, I was writing chapters and I got a comment from one of my readers. And he was saying, I wish you did more with the new characters you've invented for this story. I have to write in new characters who weren't part of the original canon to make certain scenes work. And I was extremely surprised that readers wanted more of these characters and not just ones that existed in the original canon. They were actually connecting with them. And they wanted them to be more part of the story. And that is what is happening with Mara Jade in particular.
So, Jordy, that must be like the greatest compliment you could possibly get out of your fanfic. Like someone just going, do you know what? The bits that aren't from the original work, mate, that's the hot stuff.
I basically have like two long projects I've written. One of them's published. At the time of recording this episode, I'm writing the final chapter for the second one. Currently, so it's about to be over. And the first time I wrote it, I wrote a bunch of side characters because basically the characters went to a different location. Their friends are not around. I need to write new people. And I was so conscious of the fact that I didn't want people to get annoyed by these characters that I put so much emphasis in saying, I want these to be characters people can be like, okay, they're there, they're unobtrusive, they are frustrating at times because they get in the way, they are not his cool OCs that he actually wants to write this story about. Moving on. I know why people liked those characters. I'm really surprised by the fact that people want more from these side characters who I introduced to fill out scenes. That's baffling, but I'm glad they like them.
So let's talk about these new characters. I'm not going to jump straight to Mara Jade. I'm going to leave her to the back.
Fair enough.
I want to talk about some that maybe don't do a lot in this story, but gets potentially some quite expansive roles further down the line. Captain Pelion.
I'm surprised to hear that he's going to be expanded further on. My assumption is that he is exploded in the third book and then he's gone.
Geordi. Spoilers for all of the New Republic. I apologise. You can not listen for 20 seconds. You're talking about Grand Commander General Pelion. Ruler of the remaining empire.
That's genuinely quite baffling. When we were talking about new characters, I was not expecting you to mention him.
I love him. He's amazing. He's just this guy who's always second in command and then just doesn't die and then just naturally rises to the highest ranks of power by just being alive.
That's funny. Okay, I can see why you wanted to bring him up now. That is amusing. Because his job is to be a perspective character. He gives us insight into Thrawn. He doesn't give that many commands himself. He provides commentary and he provides perspective on the character I assumed you were going to talk about, Jorun Saboeth.
Yes, let's talk about Jorun Saboeth. Jorun Saboeth is a Jedi Knight, or is he? That Thrawn finds at the start of this novel,
A dark Jedi, because we're not allowed to use the word Sith, because we don't know what it means.
Also, no, Jedi Apprentice. There is no Padawan.
That's fair. The word Padawan is a little silly.
My young Padawan. Right, yes, he is introduced. Thrawn goes to get him because, one, he's protecting some equipment Thrawn wants, and two,
mm-hmm.
Thrawn thinks he can use a bit of Jedi power in the back.
Yes, very surprised to see him show up. I should have known better, and when he did show up, I was like, oh, okay. Because the thing that they will not stop talking about whenever Jorm Saboov is around is outbound flight.
So
I did not know that this was something that had to be set up earlier. I assumed that he had a novel, new idea, but it made all of that book I read in my own time make so much more sense when I was like, I need to fill in the gaps. And clearly, Timothy Zahn wrote that book purely because he was like, the prequels are happening, new content is being added, I need to jump in as fast as I can to make sure that Thrawn is not decanonized. I need to make sure that he fits into the world perfectly. So I'm going to write his origin, and Jorm Saboov's going to be there, and all of the details I mention about it are going to be in the book, and Obi-Wan Kenobi is going to be there for some reason, even though it makes even less sense why he's there for a bit when you read this book.
So I've actually not read Outbound Flight, so I know even less about this than Geordi does. Very rare reversal for Star Wars. In this book, he definitely is there to explore the dark side and dark powers. We get a look at what someone who wants to use the Force for control looks like.
Mm.
We also get a sight into a dark Jedi who is not trying to rule the Empire. It's that, yeah. And something that Thrawn really observes is that when he rocks up, he is the king. Dark Jedi, you know, they want personal power, but not all of them are as optimistic as galactic conquest. You know, he's very happy just ruling his little bit of turf.
That's right. Jorm doesn't have a lot to do in this book, so I don't think we end up talking about him for too long. It's merely quite amusing that this bizarre character, who I was constantly being like, why the fuck is this guy here in Outbound Flight? He doesn't feel like a Jedi at all. That's why, because you need to set up this villain for a book that came out like 15 years beforehand.
What I would...
However...
Geordi, go for it.
I assume you're about to talk about the same thing, which is that what he is there to do, which is interesting, is that this is Timothy Zahn's assumption about what a clone war is.
Yes, it is. This is my favourite bit of retconning that goes on within the old Star Wars universe. The Clone Wars.
Yep.
There was an assumption about the Clone Wars, which George Lucas, in many respects, intentionally subverted. Like, he let these writers go on under this assumption so that he could have some form of pull the rug out moment, I think, later on. Or he just changed his mind on the spur of the moment and went, fuck it.
I think, somewhere in between the two, I think the truth lies. So the Clone War, according to Timothy Zahn, and I guess other writers of the era, the clones that were mentioned were cloned Jedi. Am I wrong?
They included clone Jedi. It was a collective of just clone masters and a clone army fighting the Republic. They were the enemies. They were the aggressors in the past conflict.
Which makes so much sense. And people talk about this all the time back when talking about fixing the prequels was a hot topic. The clones should be the bad guys because you want the losses on the side of the good guys to matter. You want that to be volunteers, people who enlist to fight for the good. You want it to be heroic, fighting against the evil faceless armies. Except the evil faceless army is fighting for the good guys in the prequels.
Against an evil, more faceless army. Now, the Clone Wars, granted, as they got developed, particularly in the Clone Wars animated TV show, just about swing back around to working. But it certainly makes a lot more sense to me where these initial assumptions laid. And I'm not going to lie, the amount of work that Timothy Zahn did down the line to make his Clone Wars and the actual Clone Wars match up, God, that man, he had his work cut out.
He must have been so delighted when the Forced Unleashed video games came out. He was like, thank God, someone agrees with me, cloned Jedi, yes!
Exactly, but it's an interesting look at cloning. The idea, so there are these Spartai cloning tanks in this book, and this is meant to be Thrawn's Trump. Are they not? Oh, sod it. That's
maybe a variant. Maybe in the next one. Maybe that was in Dark Empire.
No, that might be in Dark Forces, the next one. I do struggle. I'm going to say this now, Jordy. I've read this trilogy, and I've actually started reading a bit of Dark Forces.
All right.
Since finishing this book, because I always read this as a set. So I do actually struggle to differentiate. It's like Lord of the Rings. Okay, no, not like Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
Take that back. In the sense that it's very much one story that is in three volumes.
Right. Like, say, the Lord of the Rings movies where they're all filmed together, or the second and third Matrix movies.
Yes, that's right.
Completely has no idea what I'm talking about. He's never seen the third Matrix movie, has he?
It's also The Dark Force Rising, before people jump on me. It's the second book.
Okay.
Yes, and I have seen the third one. I haven't seen the fourth one.
No, neither have I. I keep forgetting it exists. Okay, so Joram taken care of. Actually, nope, I'm going to jump on this because this was quite funny. So whilst I was reading my physical book, and a book which I lost, I cannot find it anywhere, and I had to buy this book a second time on Kindle. So not only did I have to read a Star Wars book, I had to buy it twice. My first copy was full of syntax errors. Really bizarre stuff. This book came out over 30 years ago, and I am finding syntax errors. There are missing punctuation marks. There are missing commas. There are questions which are written as a question and don't have a question mark at the end. There at one point was a bit where there was no paragraph breaks in between places where perspective changed. Like whole scenes changed. I had Duncan go look at his own book, and there is a paragraph break in his book. So, this latest printing by Disney is full of obvious mistakes. And frankly, it's kind of bizarre that this would even be in such shoddy condition, considering that it is a 30-year-old book with numerous editions.
I'm actually shocked to hear about this. So my edition is the 97 edition. So this came out just before the prequels would have hit cinemas.
Mm.
So we're a little bit of the way through most of New Republic's been written. And you're right, I don't understand how errors that didn't exist in a prior publication, because I've actually checked errors that Geordie found against my copy, and they're not in my copy. It's almost as if someone, they lost like the original type, and someone just had to simply sit down at a laptop, read the book and retype it, and then just got careless. Like, that's the only way I can get how this happened.
It's possible that they like had a PDF version and like the scan didn't go through properly and they had to like make manual adjustments, or maybe it was made by AI. Maybe they plugged in the text of a book into an AI and said, "All right, reformat it to a new edition," and it made mistakes. I don't know, but it's
then
it's
hire really a proofreader. You're Disney.
Yep,
it will take them like 2 days, if that.
Also, I want to say one more thing. The front cover of my book, I really like. I think it's a great front cover. It is made of some cheap material. It was sitting in my bag for like a week when I was going to work, and it was extremely damaged at the end of a week.
Just for the record, my 97 edition is still looking good.
So there we go. Those are my complaints. I brought it up because, amusingly, I was so used to catching these mistakes that I sent a text to Duncan at one point being like, "I can't believe how many mistakes there are in this. They even misspelt one of the characters' names." And then I immediately sent back saying like, "Oh, wait, no, that was on purpose. My bad."
Oh, you wait until we get to Luke. Or should I say Luke?
Okay, now I'm very confused. But moving on, are there any other special characters you want to talk about before Mara Jade?
Yes, there is. And that is our new criminal, I don't know what you call it. Not mastermind. Just gangster leader.
Mob boss, gangster leader, smuggler.
Card.
And he has a ship called the Wild Card, which is great. Good theming. I like it.
I mean, it's very much set up in this story that this is one of the guys that kind of sprung up and came in after the death of Jabba the Hutt.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit wobbly, maybe in the full expanded universe. There are a lot of other Hutts out there. But yeah, he comes into it. And I really like this character, because at the start of the story, he is trying to be Mr. Neutral. He is, in many ways, almost a little bit early Han Solo again. You're getting a guy, he doesn't get fully involved, but, you know, for a paycheck, he's willing to do
absolutely
business.
Yeah, this is the sort of character where if Han had never met Ben, Kenobi, and Luke Skywalker in a couple of years' time, like, how much time has passed since the Battle of Yavin? Like, 8 years? So maybe in a little over 8 years. This is someone who Han could have turned into. He leveled up from being a smuggler himself. He got, like, a circle of cronies. He became a crime boss. This is sort of a little glance of what he could have been. But also, he's a really interesting character to follow for a couple of reasons. For one thing, he represents this figure of power. He's a dangerous man, but he's engaging and even kind of nice. Like, he's kind of gentle. You can tell that, like, he treats his employees well, and he's forgiving and seems very reasonable. Like, he tases Luke and locks him up, but then he's very nice to him. He's like, listen, I'm sorry that we had to do all this. It's just business.
Something always nice to see. It's nice to see, like, why people follow these leaders. If one guy's too much of an arsehole, you do just think, why doesn't just one of his cronies just put one blaster bolt in the back?
Yeah, this guy feels like a character who'd come straight out of The Expanse. He really feels lived in. He represents this, like, underbelly of space society, but it's convincing. You know, he's not just a caricature. It feels like he is the focal point for a crew. Like, this is someone you believe people would follow.
It's someone who you believe isn't just sadistic. He's not being evil for kicks. He's a good person, but he's also willing to walk whatever side the law he has to keep his people safe.
Yeah, exactly. And the conflict is that he almost has more agency than anyone else in the entire story, because he's the guy who has to decide between Republic and Empire, and he is walking so steadily down this middle line where he's thinking really clearly about things like long-term impact or, like, short-term gain by going to the Empire, but the Republic's going to win, and I'm going to keep walking down the central path, and I'm not going to choose sides until I see which way the wind's turning. And at a certain point, you watch those principles, like, break out from under him, because he's going to lose and he's forced to choose a side, and that's a really engaging moment of indecision.
And again, it's just that fleshing out of the world. Like, I do really feel, you know, this character, this original character, I'm so happy he was never made like a background character from Return of the Jedi. You know,
yeah.
This is something you see quite a lot later on, where they just pick random individuals from the background and go, oh, that was Bobby Fento. He was secretly doing all of this, and you're like, oh. It wasn't Boba Fett.
Yeah, like the droid who explodes and when it goes in front of R2-D2. There's a whole comic book where he's actually a Force-sensitive droid, and he learned to be Force-sensitive so he didn't spill drinks in Jabba's palace, and he deliberately exploded himself in order for R2-D2 to be picked up by Luke instead of him, because that was the will of the Force. Yeah, like that.
I do think that may have not been canon to start with, but yes, that story was written. There's another one where, you know, the droid that's torturing other droids in Jabba's palace, like dungeons?
Oh yeah?
That droid is one that apparently is just a sadistic droid that likes hurting other droids, and Lando nearly arrested him on Cloud City, but he got away. And between scenes in Jabba's palace, just before the sail barge leaves, Lando goes back and they have like a standoff. Of course.
That's so stupid. Fucking Star Wars. This is why sometimes it's like, yeah, it was a good thing that Disney hit a race on a lot of that bullshit. But also, we miss out on stuff like this. Let's keep talking. I think it's time we talked about Mara Jade.
Mara Jade. Interesting enough, I've just said that it's so great they don't pick random background and announce that they were a complex character the whole time. Mara Jade's a bit interesting because we get told in this book that she was one of the dancing girls in Jabba's palace.
Very strange.
She's not. There's no person of her description in the scene at all.
There are no hot redheads.
Just something Zorn was just like, I can say this. The film's not been in cinemas for 10 years. VHS is only just coming out. No one knows.
And they're pretty low res. You can squint at the smudges in the background all you like. They aren't yet being hidden behind a horrifying CGI alien singer yet.
So we get that background to Mary J, but yes, we're introduced to her. Now, this character, one of my favourites of the Expanded Universe, and I think that's true for a lot of people. Mary Jade is introduced as one of the cronies in Card's crew, and she has so much kind of extra depth that we get sort of lightly inferred to, and then we slowly get revealed as the story progresses. One thing we know very early on is that she hates Luke Skywalker. She wants to...
What? Not our Luke!
Who could hate him? He saved the galaxy. He destroyed the Death Star, killed the Emperor. And it's really nice because you get this stuff even at this moment throughout the idea of the book going, why? He said, Han Solo, you'd come up with 100 reasons.
Yeah,
spurned lover, went south on a deal, whatever. You're like, what did Luke do to you? How could he have done something to you? He went from innocent farm boy to hero.
Could she be one of the 200,000 families who lost someone on the Death Star?
Never addressed, thank you very much.
Mara Jade is a standout for a lot of reasons, and it's really surprising that the character works, because I was really prepared to be like, okay, I know this is a, like, famous character. Can she live up to the reputation she's garnered? Like, people were very specifically annoyed that this character was erased by Disney wiping out Legends. People specifically said, no. Now we're losing this character. So why is she so significant? Now, one of those reasons is that she's a hot redhead.
Good reason.
And as a man who likes hot redheads, that is a good reason. We need them. I would sorely miss a hot redhead I was invested in if they suddenly vanish off the face of the earth. However, surely there has to be more to it than that. And I was really surprised in this first book how restrained it is, because I knew what her backstory was, more or less, from, like, I don't know, a YouTube video I saw 10 years ago explaining who Mara Jade is in 5 minutes or less. And it wasn't, like, as typically DeviantArt OC edgy background as I expected. It wasn't like, say, the post or the mid-prequel comic books about Darth Maul's origin, where he's so gnarly and dark and edgy and cool, man. That's what I was expecting, and that's not what I got.
No, I think the character is, I don't say, lacks at least what we see here. So Mara Jade's backstory is that she was one of the Emperor's Hand. This, geez, was the spy, the assassin. There's in a bit where Luke's like, you worked for Vader, and she's like, excuse me, I worked for the Emperor. Do not insult me. And I think what's nice is that there's something a little bit like when she talks about time in the Empire, she's really kind of, I get a very kind of clinical vibe. You know, she wasn't Darth Vader, she wasn't oozing evil, she was just like, they've given me a job, I'm appreciative that I have a place in society, and I do my job well. You know, I don't think about the wider evil context of my organisation. And that's why she's angry at Luke, because he got rid of that structure and that world. And I think that's a really nice insight when we do talk about, you know, the fall of the Empire, is the fact that, well, it had structure. And sometimes lawful evil over chaotic good. Some people like to know what's happening tomorrow.
Yeah, the appeal of fascism in and of itself is that it's a strong arm. That's what people like about it. That's why people fall for it. They're seduced by it. Because it provides simple answers to complex questions. What I like about Mara Jade's character, and I love the fact that this is completely unstated, you just read into it through the way in which characters behave, which is the fact that Mara Jade was extremely loyal to the Emperor, so much so that she wants to get revenge against Luke for destroying him. It doesn't matter if it was actually Vader who did it, he's the one who brought him down, so he needs to pay. but she doesn't pull the trigger when she has him, because what matters is not actually the connection between her and the Emperor. It's not like they had like a close relationship, is to be understood. It's the fact that he disrupted her life. Mara Jade has a new life. Mara Jade is a part of the Wild Card crew. She works for Card. And she is so obviously unswervingly loyal. And it's really interesting that the primary attribute of your one of your principal antagonists in this story, and make no mistake, she's absolutely one of the antagonists, she is of immense personal threat to Luke, is the trait of loyalty. Loyalty is one of the most commendable traits we recognize in heroes. It's one of the things we like most about Luke. The fact that Luke is loyal to his friends. And so the reflection of that in this antagonist means that we have this thing to latch onto. It's never stated like Mara Jade needs a leader to follow, and without that, she would fall apart. We just see the way in which she's given orders, she grinds her teeth, she complains, and then she does it. And it just has to be shown. It doesn't have to be told to us, and that's impressive.
So that's very good writing then from this Star Wars tie-in novel.
That's good writing. Yes, stop pointing out the fact that I'm enjoying a Star Wars book, Duncan. It's not going to happen again!
Oh, it's going to happen so many more times over. And you're right, and I really enjoy that too. I think we see, like I said, you talk about her loyalty. You also see the fact that she doesn't pull the trigger. And that although she kind of screams and shouts at Luke, you also get, at least this is how I read into it, is that she kind of knows that her anger really isn't for this one man. I often get the impression that it was easy to hate Luke when Luke was just this idea of someone. Like, she wasn't hunting Luke. She's just like, I need to hate a face. I can't just hate the Rebellion or the New Republic. I just need to pick a face to hate. And then when she finally gets Luke, she's like, oh, you're just, why aren't you everything I've hated you to be?
This is a tricky thing. This is really tricky to talk about, because now we are arriving at the reason why I don't like talking about Star Wars, which is that I have to acknowledge the fact that Star Wars fans exist, and I fucking hate fans of Star Wars.
But we do a podcast anyway.
We do a podcast anyway. The reason why I don't like fans of Star Wars is they are the whiniest motherfuckers on the planet. They constantly go on in their little subreddits and harass actors and creative roles, and they go on these fucking disgusting tirades. And I know it's not all of them, but it's so obviously this collective of place where people cannot just enjoy children's content. They need to turn it into this prolonged campaign of their own personal frustrations against the way in which society works, and that has to be channeled through the medium of Star Wars, of all things. You can't just accept that a bad movie happened, that you can't just move on from that. And here's the problem I have. The fact is, I much prefer the depiction of Luke Skywalker in this to his depiction in the modern movies. And unfortunately, in saying that, I now sound like a fucking fascist.
Right. Okay. Stepping back into the room, people. As George has expressed, you're right, there is some incredibly not... I don't really want to use the word subset, because they are a very vocal group of Star Wars fans that push a lot of weird external politics onto this franchise, which is just not there. And they use it as a tool to talk about real-world stuff in a bizarre way. But one of the core complaints, and one of the reasons, to be honest, I got into the expanded Legends EU a long time ago, is because I heard a lot of complaints about the new Star Wars movies. I think, if I'm not mistaken, it was after The Last Jedi that I first went out and read. I believe it wasn't Heir to the Empire. I bought Heir to the Empire at the same time. I also bought the Han Solo prequel book, Paradise Snare. And one just so happened to arrive before the other, so I read that first. But I wanted to understand, well, what did they do so different? And reading this, I was very much on their side. I thought, yeah, I can see why this is more appealing, because you're getting to see your hero be heroic.
Yep.
Obviously, that's nice. But also seeing him still go through challenge. It's still his story, and his story of growth, and development, but he is still embodies all of the same elements that we see him achieve. He's still on his high from the last movie we saw him. This is a continuation and expansion on the character, whereas on the trajectory we last saw him take off on. Whereas I do feel with the sequel stuff, it is definitely an expansion and a development of the character. It's just not the trajectory we left him on, and it does leave you going,
yeah,
what, why?
Yeah, the answer to that, the why, is that by having Luke step away and deny the call of heroism, by confronting our expectation that he was going to step in, he was going to help Rey learn how to be a Jedi, by taking away from that role, we center the story instead on Rey, who is our main character. Obviously, we want it to be focused on our main character. It did not escape my notice that a huge subset of those same fans, they want Luke to step back in, you know, however many years later it is, like 30-something years, and just become the hero again. Just take over and just push all these other characters to the side. It's about Luke now. And that shouldn't be the case. If you're writing a story about Finn, and you're writing a story about Rey, and you're writing about Poe, it should be about them. So obviously you need to sideline those characters, and the way you're doing that is you're killing them off, or you're having Leia be the one who sends them on missions, or she's asleep throughout the movie. You set them to the side, and what that means is you have a bunch of fans who want this to be the movie. They liked this book, and they want this to be the principal story that gets told. And the great thing is, this book still exists. We're doing a podcast episode about it. I had never read any Star Wars book. I've read a grand total of 3 Star Wars books. This is the third one, and I'm enjoying this one. It still exists. You can just read it.
It's this weird dichotomy where I deal with some people talking about, oh, they decanonized it, or the legend, so it like never happened. I'm like, mate, Star Wars never happened. It doesn't matter. It's still there. It is just as real as it ever is.
Yep.
Don't sweat it. Enjoy it. We still have it. And also, this is the positive of the medium. This is why books are so great, because they don't have budgets. You know, you can have thousands of starships on screen just as cheaply as you can have none. And your characters can be any age. You don't have to worry. And the actors can always be in their peak moments. And Luke gets to be the hero. Because why wouldn't he?
Anyway, I'm sorry that we weren't in that extended rant, but this is why I don't like talking about Star Wars books.
But then let's just remember why we are talking about it, because I think this is just a good book in and of itself. Geordie, here's a question for you. Hypothetical. Imagine a world, and this is actually going to be incredibly challenging. Can you imagine a world where this book was just handed to you and you hadn't seen the films?
That's a good question. This book would make no sense.
I personally think you're absolutely right. They give that, and it's a safe assumption, but you're right. This isn't quite stand alone.
No, not at all. I mean, it's not supposed to be standalone. It was never written to be, and a book standing by itself is not necessarily the highest mark of quality. It's totally fine to be connected to a wider work. I do think that that's going to be an issue in the future of Star Wars, knowing how confusing and bloated it gets. Just last year, you took us on an exploration of Dark Empire, and that's like the follow-up to this. That came out like, what, a couple of years later, or even like a year later, or at the same time?
Around the same, I think we're talking a matter of months.
And you talk about how in that, Leia is pregnant again. And there's like a Sith prophecy focused on that child. And you're being like, because he didn't know that Leia was pregnant in another book series that was coming out. And he should have just focused on those kids that already existed.
Go back and listen to The Dark Empire. There is so much to unpack there. But you're right. It is confusing. And it's because of the interlinked nature. I think what's really good to say, though, about Heir to the Empire. So, yeah, that question was actually to lead me into this point. You're right, you do need to watch the original trilogy, obviously, to read this book, but you only need to watch the original trilogy in order to read this book.
That's right, exactly.
And it doesn't, I don't think, even though I have read so many more Expanding Universe books, you've read Outbound Flight, so maybe you might slightly change your mind on this, but this book was written, intended and still stands as just the next step. You have finished Return of the Jedi. You need nothing else. And this is the next powerful step. Chronologically, it's not. There's like 10 books between Return of the Jedi and this.
The X-Wing books, right?
Yes. X-Wing, to be honest, great series. Michael Stackpole, great author. Love the guy.
Are they all just about Wedge Antilles?
So there's an original character called Corran Horn, who appears in those books. And he actually appears in later Timothy Zahn books. But you're right. Wedge Antilles is the wing commander, and Corran Horn is the maverick of the group. And it is.
Now, I was going to say that something that I've never understood about the wider Star Wars universe is how obsessed people are with the character of Wedge Antilles. Because when I was watching the Star Wars movies as a kid, I had no idea that he existed. I had no idea that this guy was at multiple destructions of various Death Stars. I didn't care. I didn't pay attention. But people love this guy for some reason.
Wedge Antilles, and he appears in this book, is just the go-to.
He's quite good in this book.
He's just he's the other rebel. If there needs to be a rebel soldier that isn't the main heroes, it's always Wedge. That's who he is. But you're right, he has his own books, he's in the X-Wing, which actually are really good books, showing you characters that don't have that sort of plot shield of like the big four, big five. No, big four. And so that is really thrilling. But there's also books like Choose a Baccarat, where you see, what did Luke do literally the day after he woke up from his Ewok hangover? Don't you want to know? Geordie, Han and Leia, they're married in this book. We don't get to see the wedding. Don't you want a book to show you that?
No, I don't. What are you talking about? That's insane.
Another good thing that Timothy Zahn does in this book, and I really can't keep praising it, I think going through the characters is the best way to show what Zahn does so well. But he does just make loads of other creative decisions, which I think are really healthy for doing this very challenging thing, expanding an established work. He does that time gap. I said before, it's good because it like elasticates where the characters can be. But it also just gives him just breathing room in general. We're back. We're on Coruscant. By the way, Geordie, first time Coruscant ever named or referenced.
That's fascinating.
Zahn created it. In fact, there's quite a few things.
And it's not described as a city-sized a city that covers a planet. It's just a planet.
Yeah, it is. I believe it has Imperial City on it, potentially at this point.
Mm-hmm.
It does become, I think, a city-wide planet in the books before the prequels, but not here. There's the other bits of technology as well. There's the vibroblades.
Yep, it's a surprise to see that invented here.
This is it. This is where they were invented.
Wow, there we go.
This is the little not lightsaber knives that you see, I think in The Mandalorian we see them.
Yep, you see them in the Prison Break episode in season one.
Lots of additions.
I hate being a fan of Star Wars and I know this shit. So embarrassing. Why can't we talk about Star Trek books? At least I'm a proud Trekkie.
I know so little about those books. I could do a next gen one, actually. But on this podcast, we're fantasy only.
Yeah, when one day, when we have, like, tons of fans and we have a Patreon, we'll do a Star Trek-themed occasional episode there.
That sounds amazing.
That's a promise I will live to regret. One day when we're podcasting superstars, parking our limos outside Hudson's Chinese, in the future our podcasts will all be screened at movie theatres after the Great Revolution.
So, Geordie, we've basically thrown nothing but praise at this book. Is there anything you want to, like, gun for? A niggle? You said some bad things about the character of Jorah Kiabo-Owo, the Dark Jedi, and the syntax. But is there anything fundamental to how this is put together? You're like, nah, it's good tie-in, but it's not good literature.
I have quibbles regarding how small the galaxy is. Like, they just run into stuff by coincidence a bunch. I think that I don't like the fact that Luke is a little bit too gung-ho with his lightsaber at times. Like, there's a bit where he just, like, charges through the room and kills 10 people with his lightsaber. And obviously Luke kills people. Like, that's just a thing he does. He's a rebel fighter. But it is a bit too Conan-y for my taste, for Luke Skywalker just be like cutting people down. I much prefer the bit at the end where he like chops down pillars and he does like a clever trick with his lightsaber. That feels more appropriate.
It sort of makes you feel like this Luke wouldn't have done his whole ploy in Jabba's palace. He would have just walked in with his lightsaber and gone, okay, Jabba, wept off the head, job done.
Exactly. I don't really like that too much because I don't want Jedi to just be murder hobos. I want him to be something more. Other than that, do I have any other problems? I don't like the fact that you made me read a book which has a cliffhanger because you wanted me to pick it as the next book.
Geordi, I would never be so manipulative. And I know you have internal fortitude. Look at me. I've been resisting the next Scholomance books for months.
It's over a year, actually.
And I really like them.
But who's counting? Yeah, great. You motherfucker. All right. Duncan, I think I've accidentally done a perfect segue to the end of the episode. Who do you recommend this book for?
Star Wars fans? I don't recommend it for not Star Wars fans, that's for sure.
Yeah, if you... Yeah. No, wait! I have a complaint! What the fuck, Timothy Zorn?
What do you do?
Hot chocolate?
Yeah.
I showed that to my girlfriend and she went, that's not right.
So much to infer. Like, is it a planet that just so happens to also have the identical like cocoa bean? Or did Lando find Earth?
That's just hot chocolate. Lando introduced Luke Skywalker to hot chocolate. Is there more chocolate? Does that get brought up in future books? Or is that one mistake that could never be
wiped away? No. They lean into it. Like, Lando Calrissian is hot chocolate and ice cream. It's just one of his things. It's his schemes, mate.
That's funny. Good. I'm very pleased to hear that. All right, let's move over towards the end. I also recommend this book to fans of Star Wars. It's the best Star Wars book that I have read. It makes me like Outbound Flight less, though. I already was souring on it, but now it feels so cynical. And I cannot recommend a book in the slightest anymore. But definitely, I do recommend this book. It's sad that we now have to move on to other pastures.
Regrettable, but very much needed. Can I just ask you, Geordi, quickly, if we are not continuing, how do you feel about Heir to the Empire as a, you know, incomplete narrative? Does it still give you enough?
I think that it is a pretty extreme cutoff. You know, a lot of threads are still dangling. You've got the Nogri with Leia that's not resolved. You've got the Mara Jade and Luke Skywalker. You've got Thrawn's future plans. Yeah, it's not a complete narrative in the slightest.
And that's something I alluded to earlier. I feel very similar, that I often have read this as a trilogy again and again, because do read this first book and I think you will enjoy it, but you're right, it even looking back now, it all blends into one, because it really does feel like one narrative over three volumes.
I mentioned a couple of episodes ago in our top 50 episode about how Strange of a Dreamer is the only book in the entire podcast where one of us has gone, well, I have to read the next one. We've read sequels on the podcast, but normally it's just because we're like, yeah, we want to follow this thread through to the end, but we absolutely could go elsewhere. We didn't have to read The Subtle Knife after The Northern Lights, but we chose to. The end of Stranger Dreamer was so intense and so cliffhangery that you had no choice but to read the next book. And we're kind of at a similar point here, which is why the next book we're going to be reading is Dark Force Rising.
Okay. I thought...
You motherfucker! You made me enjoy Star Wars book so much I wanted to read the next one, and I have been reading it! I've already started reading it!
I have too.
Duncan, I bought the next two books.
Oh, Geordi, can you imagine if I don't pick the third? If I leave you dangling there?
You I will skin you if you don't do it. But in a nice, family-friendly way.
I am delighted. I am actually, I'm overjoyed. Geordie, you're about to go on, I think, the most satisfying Star Wars journey you probably have ever had since watching the original trilogy for the first time. It is a delight, and I'm very smug for introducing it to you.
Do you think the next book is better than the first one?
It has some very strong plot. Some of the characters... I don't know. I can't tell you yet. I've got to reread it, Geordie. It certainly has some character plots are better than their part in the first book. Leia definitely comes to the forefront in the next book. However, other characters, maybe they drop back a bit. And I think that's an ebb and flow we'll see over all three books in this series. Because I can't see myself not picking the final book after this, Geordie.
Alrighty then. Alrighty.
If you have read Heir to the Empire, seen Star Wars, or just have an opinion on what we've just said, please do reach out and let us know at If It's Just Fantasy Podcast on Instagram. You can also reach out to us at our Gmail, isthisfantasypodcast@gmail.com. Love to hear your thoughts. If you think we've completely done Star Wars dirty, feel free to send a shouty ranty message. I'm sure I will still read it.
I want to interrupt here and say that there's a possibility, I don't know how the timelines are going to line up here, there's a possibility that the next episode you're going to hear will not be Dark Forces Rising, it may be Children of Anguish and Anarchy, or whatever it's called, Anarchy and Anguish, the last book in the Children of Blood and Bone series, because that book is coming out quite soon relative to where we are recording this. And we are definitely going to jump in, read that as quick as we can, and then get a review out. And I don't know whose pick that will be. I literally have no idea because I picked the last one, but it was by spending a destiny point to make you read it. I have no idea if that even counts as
I think
pick.
We'll do it as a mutual agreement for the good of the podcast. We both want to see that series finished, and it's always fun to do it in a timely manner and be part of the zeitgeist of a new book released, just like we were with Empire of the Damned. It's a lot of fun. So yes, while we are doing the Thrawn trilogy, as it has been called in the past, or not really called now, Heir to the Empire trilogy, we may get ponk that one in just so we can be with you all.
It is called a Thrawn trilogy on the cover of my book.
Interesting. In the back of my book, it's actually just called the Empire trilogy. They have renamed it over the years.
That's interesting. I guess because Thrawn became such an influential character.
But then they brought out another Thrawn trilogy later down the line, so it gets very confusing.
Yes, that's true. That is true. I've been your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I've been your other host, Duncan Nicol. Till next time.
May the Force be with you.
Always.